Accession number 27185, reel 19.
Major Barras, reel 19. Can you remember where you went next after being deployed at Highcliffe?
Well, my mind's a bit hazy now, but very shortly after Highcliffe, if I didn't go anywhere else, I got a request from Brigadier Blest, who was our old CO at 2nd Essex, who was now Brigade Commander of 25 Infantry Brigade, if I'd like to go there as his Brigade IO. The CO was apparently prepared to release me. So I went to 205 Brigade. At that time, I think they were stationed on the Isle of Wight, not far from, either in Newport or not far from Newport.
What was the intelligence setup at 25 Brigade like? What sort of...
Very small. There was myself, and I think about two or three other ranks, sergeant, couple of corporals. It wasn't a very intensive job, actually, at that time. I mean, it's more a wartime job at a brigade level. I spent a lot of my time going around with Henry Blest, going around when he visited battalions in the local district. And when we went on exercises, I really did for him what I used to do for my CO, in other words, prepare his maps, send out situation reports, collect information, inform next higher up headquarters, which in this case was 47 Div, of any information that we thought we should pass on to them about the enemy in our own situation. Normally, of course, there would be regular times for doing this during the day. There'd be at the end of the day, there was always a time for sending in regular sit reps of the activities of the whole past 24 hours.
What was in the brigade at that time? Do you remember all that?
I can't. Apart from the 2nd Essex, I have no... My mind's a complete blank as to who else was there.
And you mentioned you're going on exercise. What sort of training and exercises were they carrying on with at that time?
Well, they were mostly advanced to contact. And sometimes you find one side was doing enemy, in which case they would dig in and they'd be attacked. But they were very mobile exercises in those days, to get on the road and have an objective to go to, and then wait until you hit the enemy. Then it was a question of what the forward CO did or the forward company commander did.
What was his recommended course of action? What did the brigade commander hope he would do once he ran into the enemy?
I think it depended entirely on the situation, really. I mean, how strong the enemy were. Well, first of all, he'd really want to pinpoint where the enemy were and get some estimate of their some estimate of their strength. I think his first inclination would be to drive in their outposts so that they stopped. They didn't have to get the information which they were previously getting. And then once he'd got done that, he would perhaps, if there was some commanding ground there which was held and would help his position to get on further if he took it, he would try to take it, but he'd want more information. I think patrolling would have to go out. I mean, he'd want some air photographs as well from the RAF, but not in the early stages. I think when he'd go as far as he could without... and then as soon as he came up to a very stiff opposition, then he'd have to stop and think. But then you'd probably find a divisional commander would come in at this stage, and the thing would get out of into a bigger operation altogether. But sometimes you can drive the enemy in, and if they were... just a sort of an outpost or a vanguard of some sort, and drive them in, and then go on until you met their main defences, probably 2 or 3 miles later on.
It sounds from what you're saying as though these exercises were going on at quite a high scale.
Yes, they were, yeah.
Were these exercises on the Isle of Wight, or would you have to go across the mainland?
Oh, no, they were mostly all on the mainland. There wasn't the space to do them. I mean, the normal training went on the Isle of Wight, and I think the 2nd Essex were on the Isle of Wight for some of the time. But, of course, normal individual training, section training, platoon training. I don't think the town exercises took place there, but normal things like range firing, field firing, route marches. We had to keep going on those to keep our feet in fit condition. Normal training that was you could carry on, but if you wanted to do anything bigger than that, then you had to go on the mainland.
So it sounds as though step one on encountering the enemy would be to explore the enemy's position insofar as you could.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And having explored the enemy's position, was there a preference for a form of attack or for a part of the enemy position to attack?
It varied, really. I mean, the layout of the ground was very important, the positions of the enemy. If there are any minefields there, for instance, and all that sort of thing, and what their support artillery and mortaring and tanks, and you had to take all these things into consideration. You probably didn't know about them when you first came up against them until gradually they started revealing their full armoury. But obviously the forward battalion commander was expected to get as far as he possibly could, and not to give up too early and get the rest of the brigade or division involved in something which was unnecessary, and would probably take lose time, because you had to get more back on the road again to advance. So if you could brush the enemy aside in the first instance, then it was up to the battalion commander to do it. Battalion commanders were all different. Some were more audacious than others. I think it was Montgomery who said there are no bad battalions, only bad COs, and I think he was absolutely right. If you've got a good CO, then the rest of the battalion will respond.
Was audacity generally regarded as a desirable quality?
Yes, I think you had to have a tinge, a bit of caution with it, though. You didn't go dashing on in and get it and incur a lot of casualties for no reason at all.
So it couldn't be pure binge.
No, not pure binge, no. There were occasions when individual could exercise or audaciousness, I mean, obviously. But as a commander of troops under you, then audaciousness was not really the thing. I mean, immediate action was a very good thing, but to let it get out of hand because you've had this sort of bit between your teeth without thinking of the consequences was not a good thing.
A bit of a different matter.
That's
a
yes.
So you had to mark maps up. What else were you employed to do, called the CO? It sounds like you were.
Well, I did some strange things when I was there, actually, which were outside the brigade. I was sent on a short camouflage course at Old Sarum, which was run by a well-known artist in those days called Edward Seago.
Yes.
It was only about 3 or 4 days. It was really teaching us how to use nets and disappear into the countryside, so to speak. He was most amusing. I remember he called himself a camoufleur, he said. But he kept us entertained, but it was quite interesting. It was more to do with camouflage in the field than anything else. Correct use of colour to blend with local colours. Really, it was really quite a simple, straightforward course.
Which particular branch of the army was in charge of camouflage at that time? Do you remember if it was a particular corps that was...
I really don't know, because in wartime a lot of experts got into the army or into all the services, called up and used their expertise. And there were occasions, I suppose, when experts came in and found themselves going on a cook's course, which wasn't intended. But I couldn't, I don't know. I couldn't even think of what it would be. He may have been attached just as an individual to a corps headquarters.
Do you remember if he was in uniform?
Oh, yes, he was in uniform,
so
yeah. Oh, yes.
Been inducted.
Oh, yes. No, he had a rank. I think he was major at that time. They all came in and became majors straight away, so a lot of these people. But he obviously knew a lot about colour and camouflage and so forth.
Do you think that your camouflage skills were improved by going on that particular course?
I don't think. I mean, if I didn't know really what he was putting across already, having been company commander for two or three years now, and been out, I don't think I learnt very much more.
What was the state of your knowledge of the enemy forces at that stage? Did you get regular updates on the German army?
Oh, yes. Yes, as an IO I did. I got pamphlets. Pamphlets showing the certain identification of uniforms, the organization of panzer and panzer grenadier and infantry divisions. They all came down, and I think I went round and gave one or two lectures, as far as I can remember, to selected officers in each battalion on it. I'm not sure whether we had enough of these pamphlets to hand them out, but they were very useful. I'm not sure whether we got, at that stage, knew the order of battle of the Germans in Western Europe. We certainly knew it later, before we went over.
What about geographical intelligence, about the nature of the ground and so on in Northwest Europe? Were you...
Not at that stage,
not at that
no. Because we're still in 1943. Everybody was fairly convinced that what was then called the Second Front was going to take place sometime in the following year. That's why we all stuck it. Why we all stuck to our units. I mean, we were with nobody in the Second Essex at that time, as far as I remember, ever thought of volunteering to go to another regiment abroad. We all stuck in together, knowing, hoping that at some stage we would finish up on the Second Front. The other thing which I was sent off on was a boat trip round the Isle of Wight one night. I can't remember, and I don't know whether I knew at the time what it was all about, but I was sent down to Portsmouth, I think it was, and I boarded HMS Wellington, which was a headquarters ship. And the first thing I remember going there was going into the wardroom and being given a pink gin, I think, yes, pink gin it was. And from there we sailed that evening with a convoy of other ships. And we just went out into the channel, round the Isle of Wight, and back again the next morning. Now, I suppose there might have been several reasons for doing that. I mean, getting the enemy used to the fact that convoys came out into the channel before the Second Front was launched. Whether we were there as a bait to draw out E-boats for the Navy to have a go at further down in the channel. Whether it was a bit of deceit.
Might have been practicing convoy drills.
Well, it might have been. Yes, it could have been. But there weren't very many ships. I can't remember how many ships. But you're quite right, it could have been a convoy drill.
You say it was a headquarters ship.
Yes.
What were the characteristics and facilities of the headquarters ship?
Well, it would be where the admiral in charge of the convoy would be. Therefore, it was the central communications.
Did it have any sort of special operations room?
I just can't remember anymore. I'm ashamed to say, the only thing I can remember is drinking pink gin in their wardroom. That's it. But I do remember going round the Isle of Wight at night. Whether I went to bed or not, I even can't remember that.
Could you see anything looking
no.
towards the island?
No, nothing at all. It was all dark. Mm. Mind you, the nights were pretty short in at that time, so I must have, some of it must have been in daylight. So the next thing we did with the Brigadier was that the Americans had arrived, beginning to arrive, and there was a what was known as a combat group, which was equivalent to an infantry brigade in the American Army, as I'm sure you know, stationed in, I think it was Wiltshire. Somehow or other, Brig Blest got to hear about this or got in contact, and we were invited to go over and visit them. So he and I went over there, and they were in a sort of ad hoc accommodation in a big house with outbuildings, which they were using. And it was Brigadier General Hickey, I remember, was the chap in charge. And he and him, Henry Blest, went into one room and started chatting. And I was introduced to what was equivalent to their brigade major. I don't know quite what his rank was. He was a major, but I don't know what his title was. We went into his office and sat down, and then he went over to his filing cabinet, opened it up, and brought out a bottle of scotch, which to me was, you know, sort of, I mean, we wouldn't dare do anything like that. So we sat there drinking scotch, and then eventually the two big men came in and said they were going to lunch, so we went off to lunch. And it turned out that there was only one place where you could have lunch, and that was in an outhouse where everybody was having lunch. And they were doing it in shifts, so it was going on all the time. So we sat down, we were given mess tins, and we got into a queue. And there was Brigadier Blest. I mean, he'd been in the British Army, I suppose, for 30 years. He was there in his shiny sort of riding boots and breeches and things with his red tabs, queuing up with a mess tin. He didn't at all think it was beneath him at all. He thought it was the whole thing was a great big joke. Anyway, we queued up and we sat down. And the whole time there was sort of movement going on. There were sort of soldiers going from one end, coming in from one door, fully equipped with helmets and equipment, and walking straight past the table and going out of another door. We were given marmalade, I remember, at varying intervals, and coffee at varying intervals, which was completely new to us at that stage. I mean, we only drank, you know, you drank coffee in the middle of the morning and then after a meal. So this was going on all the time. And then...
What was the quality of the food like compared to your own?
Ooh, I can't remember what it was, but I can't even remember what we ate. I know we ate out of these mess tins, slightly different from ours. They were sort of round, I think.
Round rather than square.
Yeah, that's right.
British mess tins were oblong, weren't they, at that stage?
Yes, they were sort of like that, with a handle.
That's it.
And whilst we were eating, a black soldier came in with one of those sort of baseball caps with the peak turned up in the front, you know, like that, with a broom. And he was coming along, sweeping under the table, and he said to us, "Do you mind lifting your feet up?" You say, we all lifted our feet up whilst he brushed underneath. It was quite an experience, actually. I mean, I quite sympathise with them. I mean, they'd only just arrived. They got a huge number of troops there. I don't think they had adequate accommodation. So I don't know whether they lived like this all the time, or the officers and the chaps all sort of hugger-mugger.
Did you get any sort of impression of your opposite number of this brigade major equivalent? What sort of man was he, do you think?
He was quite mature, as far as I can remember. He was older than me. I can't even remember what we just talked pleasantly, as I think. But he seemed quite a pleasant individual. I'd say he was reasonably sound sort of chap. Otherwise, I suppose he wouldn't have had be in a position like that. But after that, I mean, I have met some strange officers in other people's armies now and again, and in our own, I suppose.
Did you get any impression of what part of the United States he was from?
No, I didn't. No, I can't remember. I mean, in those days, I think it was they were probably the first Americans I'd ever met. I mean, we never travelled abroad in those days very much, before the war. certainly once the war had started, you only travelled abroad if you were going to fight somebody. People didn't go to America so much. I mean, you saw the Queen Mary and the Elizabeth sailing with nothing but film stars on board. Only you had to be very rich.
What impression did you get of the American soldiers when you were in amongst them?
I didn't get a chance really to appraise them properly. I mean, I came across them later in Northwest Europe after the breakout and so forth. I couldn't say at that stage. I think they were still pretty raw. I mean, it was the early days. I think they had a lot of training to do. And I don't even know whether they were going to take part in the actual assault on the beaches, or whether they were follow-up, or whether perhaps they didn't get to get across till quite some time later. I don't know. I don't know what their job was going to be.
Did you visit them again? Or was
this no, it's just a one-off. We invited them back and gave them a sort of a taste of our mess with a little bit of silver out and that sort of thing. But it wasn't fair, really, to compare our situation with theirs, because they were obviously in a sort of...
Well, you were at home, weren't you?
We were at home, and they were in a very temporary situation. The only other thing which I can remember doing whilst I was at Brigade Headquarters was going off to Wales. There was a big exercise being held in Wales. I can't remember what it was called, and I can't remember what its objectives were, but it was quite a very large one.
Would it be corps level, perhaps?
It could have been.
Because you talked about division commands getting involved in training and
training.
Yes. So next stage up would be corps, wouldn't it?
Yes. It might could well have been. I know it was a big exercise. The 2nd Essex had gone there. Had gone from the brigade and had gone over there for various duties. I think they were involved in the exercise. They were there for other duties.
For administration?
Yes, that sort of thing. And whilst they were there, the brig said, you better go off and visit them and see how they're getting on and give them my best wishes and that sort of thing. So I find myself at Old Sarum again, just about to embark on my first flight in an aeroplane. And I can remember it to this day. It was an Anson, I think, with only about four or five, half dozen seats in it. And in the aeroplane, there were sort of brigadiers and me, temporary captain. And they were all sitting in seats, and I was sort of sitting on the luggage, which was at the back of the cabin, which, I mean, would never be allowed these days. And the pilot was an American, dressed in dark blue uniform of the ATA, I think they call them, Auxiliary Transport something. They used to deliver aircraft. They'd go and pick them up in the factories, Spitfires, bombers, and then go and deliver them to the RAF at the various aerodromes. Now this guy, and they'd fly the communications aircraft as well. And this guy was American, I remember, and he had a twitch in his neck, and he used to sort of look down at his map, and then sort of like this, you know, to look out of the window, and then down again like this. That didn't give us much encouragement. Anyway, we took off, and he got a map sort of spread out on his lap, and I swear I could see the sort of Himalayas etched in purple from where I was sitting. Anyway, we took off, and we'd been going some time, and then we were all sitting back, and the engines were humming away. And also, I see him looking out of the window, and he's looking down his map again, looking out of the window. And then he sort of turned around to us and said, "Say, any of you guys know the way?" Literally his words. And I've never seen four or five brigadiers snap their books so quickly together and look out of the window. And there we were, over the ocean. We were miles away from land. I mean, you know, there were big ships plying backwards and forwards underneath. No sight of land at all. Anyway, well, I suppose one of the brighter brigadiers looked out of the window, saw where the sun was, and said, "I reckon you should turn right." So his exact words were, "Okay, you're the boss," he said, "and turn right." And luckily, we hit land, and it was South Wales. And he lost his way then, and we went all through the round the valleys of South Wales, and eventually he landed at an RAF station, which wasn't the one we were intending to land at. He taxied alongside the sort of administration building there, opened his cockpit window, and at that same time, the window in the administration building opened as well. It was on about the same level. And a sort of a typical senior RAF officer with scrambled egg all over his peak and a great big moustache shouted out, "What the devil do you think you're doing?" You see, and him. Anyway, the brigadiers at the back said, "That's all right, I don't mind where we are, we're all getting off here." So they all got off and ordered their cars. But I had to stay with this man until we found Tenby. Anyway, he did in the end. I don't know how they ever got me back in an aeroplane again after that experience.
Did he not have a navigator with him?
No, he was just on his own.
Did you see what kind of maps and charts he had?
No, I just saw he got this one on his lap. Mm. I think it must have been a small-scale one. Mm. It probably wasn't even of the area. I don't know. I don't know how I got back. I hope I didn't go back with him.
Well, I think in those days, aircraft would often navigate by flying along railways, wouldn't they, or major roads?
Yes.
Act as landmarks.
Yeah. Well, all he had to do was to cross the River Severn.
True.
And then go down the Welsh coast, but
head northwest and cross the
Yeah, coast. But I think he thought his only way was to head for America.
Perhaps he mistook the distance.
Yes, I think he thought if he sort of put his sights towards New York, he couldn't go wrong.
Being men would realise how small England and Wales are compared to the United States.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, my God. Yeah. Well, after that, of course. There wasn't much more until we moved, the whole division moved up to Durham. And now we're talking of January 1944. It moved up to the county of Durham. And brigade headquarters was sited in a very cold castle, I remember. No central heating. This was January in Durham. And I remember the thing that stays in my mind as going into what was my bedroom, which was in one of the keeps, I think, and looking out of a sort of a slit in the wall, which must have been used by men with bows and arrows in the old days, and just freezing. Anyway, I don't know why we went to Durham. I don't know what we were doing there. And I can't remember anything else other than that. I think we were there for about 10 days to 2 weeks. And then the whole division was moved down to Yorkshire to act as enemy in an exercise called Exercise Eagle. And this took place on the Yorkshire Wolds, just north of Driffield, I think.
Do you know who you were acting as enemy for?
Yes, it turned out, I worked it out actually, the enemy we came across eventually who came our way were the Irish Guards, so it must have been the Guards Armoured, who were in 8 Corps, and it was an 8 Corps exercise, with, they had the 15th Scottish and the 11th Armoured in there, so we came across the Guards at that time.
What sort of enemy were you providing? Were you trying to simulate German tactics, or were you using British tactics?
No, we just dug in. And stayed there. The thing about this is that at this time I got wind that I suppose the brigadier told me that 2nd Essex were going to be earmarked for taking part in the force that was going to take part in the Second Front. So I asked if I could go back to my regiment at that stage, battalion. And he was willing to release me, and luckily the CO was willing to have me back. And more luckily, I got a company, which was C Company. And more luckily, because all company commanders were majors in those days, I suddenly found myself as a temporary major. So I went back just in time for the beginnings of Eagle with the 2nd Essex as C Company commander. With snow on the ground, it stayed there all the time. We were dug in. It was quite boring, actually, because we didn't have very much to do except wait for the enemy. And they didn't appear for some time. I assumed that they were doing some